Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Scott Jacek of Inside Higher Ed. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Scott Jacek, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to today's audio conference on hiring in academia. All colleges hire, and all colleges are judged in part by the quality of their hires, and not just for the most visible hires. Hiring in academia is not only important, but complicated. Higher education is far more decentralized than many entities in the corporate world. That means lots of people are involved with a wide range of knowledge bases. Our presenter today, Kathleen Reinhart, is an expert on the professional and legal issues involved with hiring in academia. She is general counsel at St. Xavier University in Chicago. Previously, she had an education law-focused private practice with numerous college and university clients. And she is a principal in Conflict Consultants Network, which provides dispute resolution and academic consulting services to colleges and universities. During the first half hour, Kathleen will lead us through the PowerPoint you all should have received. If any of you didn't receive it, please email me at info@insidehighered.com, and I'll get it to you right away. Shortly before the end of the presentation, we'll let you know how to ask questions, and then we'll have a Q&A. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you very much, Scott, and hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with all of you today. I provided quite a bit of information in this PowerPoint, which should be easy to read and to follow. We will save a good chunk of time, as Scott mentioned, for questions, but I also invite you to follow up with me at reinhart@sxu.edu if you have a question about the materials that has not been answered during the Q&A or may need some clarification. I also will be referencing slides, even though I'm not going to read through each slide. I may highlight things on certain pages. So if you are projecting the slide or you have it printed out by page, I will reference the slide that I'm on and the page number so that we can stick together on this. We have a lot to cover, so let's begin. I'm moving to the next slide on page 2, entitled Hiring in Academia. And as all of you know, the daily challenges for supervisors and other decision makers on campus continue to increase not only in number, but also in complexity. And two of the most critical challenges in terms of potential strategic and legal consequences involve effective hiring and performance evaluations. In both of these areas, critical mistakes can occur that lead to conflict, to formal grievances, or even on occasion to potential legal exposure. Our focus today will be on the development of effective and legally compliant hiring policies and procedures. And I'm moving to the next slide. In addition, I want to provide you a number of practical and effective tools that will serve you well during the hiring process. And an additional goal, I would like to propose a number of best practices to support all of you who occupy supervisory roles or decision-making roles on campus. The best practices or tools that I want to offer to you are more specifically described over the next several slides, and we can discuss them further in the Q&A period. But what I would like to encourage you to keep in mind is something that you already know. The work you have to do is hard, and it's getting harder. The other piece I want to just stress is that effective supervision is skill-based. It's not something that happens by osmosis, and very rarely when you are asked to assume a supervisory role do you get the required formal training for supervision that really would be helpful during an age of increased compliance and certainly increased legal, where the litigation landscape has increased over time. So what I've described to supervisors, deans and chairs and provosts and others with whom I work on a regular basis is presume that we have entered the land of don't do this alone, and there is no turning back. We have entered the land of don't do this alone, where legal compliance realities simply require us to make sure that we are working together much more effectively in terms of our preparation and training in order to develop a more reflective, holistic, and engaged approach to supervision. So I am now on page 6 of the materials, and that's entitled at the top, Supervisory Best Practices. And at the top, it talks about incorporating certain essentials. I want to propose a couple of fundamental tools that I have been working on encouraging campuses to adopt in every possible in-service that I have been working on, that not only is applicable to the hiring issues that we're going to discuss today, but it really is applicable to everything you are going to do within the framework of your supervisory responsibilities. First, there are three foundational pillars that really undergird everything we must be able to do on campus today in a supervisory or decision-making role. And those three pillars are notice, clarity, and consistency in all your communications. So notice is notice of the rule, notice of the process, making sure that it's out there. Clarity in the communication of that rule or process, and consistency in the application of that rule or best practice or process. The second component in supervisory best practices to kind of tuck away in your own tool chest is what I've referred to as the due diligence checklist. It provides an essential framework and common language that is applicable for faculty, for staff, and for all supervisors, creating a common language that is critical for all of us in the effective management of issues that we must address on campus, whether it's hiring, evaluation, whatever the issue might be. And so there are 6 components to this checklist, and I'm happy to come back to this during the Q&A to elaborate on them a little more, but it really creates that common language and common framework through which all of us can get our work done effectively and in a compliant way on campus. Turning to the next slide, with these frameworks in mind, we also are aware that the number of legal claims faced by colleges and universities today continues to rise. It has been suggested that at any one time, campuses are facing an average of 5 claims or potential claims on campus. The origins of many of these claims can be traced to hiring policies and procedures. Were they clear? Were they consistently applied? Did we hire the best person or did we settle? Did we rush the search process? Did we feel that we were only limited to the final candidates, even though the search committee may have determined that we weren't comfortable with the final pool of candidates? Did we understand and agree upon what we actually needed in order to recruit the best possible pool of candidates? And if you move to the next slide, you know, it's important as we think about the issues that we face internally with regard to how we manage the selection of candidates, how we engage in the hiring process, that there are external parties that are very much watching how we manage hiring and our effectiveness in hiring or evaluation or the other types of processes that are critical to our operations. For example, insurance carriers increasingly assess the scope and cost of coverage for institutions based upon the institution's engagement in enterprise risk management, which essentially requires kind of a de-siloization on campus, and it requires all of us to start from the premise that everything we do and say is no longer vacuum-packed in one particular department or area, that what we say and do is going to be seen by someone, heard by someone, used by someone, maybe in a manner we never intended, but there will be an impact in some way, and that as we speak on behalf of the institution, it's critical for us to develop a much more, as I mentioned earlier, much more holistic approach in the management of campus issues and operations. And certainly effective hiring and evaluation are integral for the success of enterprise risk management. On the next slide, therefore, we must really examine our hiring policies and procedures, because we as the institution who develops the job postings, develops the job descriptions, carries out the policies and procedures, we will be expected to identify and defend the decision-making frameworks that we use. So if you move two slides ahead to hiring policies and procedures, the first question that we have to consider is, when is the last time that we actually did a pretty good internal audit of our hiring policies and procedures in order to ensure that the framework tools that I introduced earlier with regard to notice, clarity, consistency, that they are reflected in our policies and procedures? When's the last time we really took a hard look at job description, or the forms or processes used, or the type of training or in-services that we provide? Keeping in mind as we go forward through the rest of the next 20 minutes or so on this, that our job descriptions will be the driver of it all. If we don't have the information we need in the job description from the moment we are ready to conduct a search or discuss the hiring process, we're really going to face a flawed process. If you move now three slides ahead on hiring policies and procedures, there are a couple of questions posed there. Do you provide legal seminars and in-services on an annual basis? Do you regularly work with human resources and legal counsel? Again, drawing from the do not do this alone premise, it's really important to be able to collaboratively rely on those who have experience and expertise in particular areas that you may not have had to develop yourself. For example, consider the laws that factor into the hiring process. We have Title VII, which prohibits discrimination. We have the Americans with Disabilities Act. We have the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, Immigration and Nationality Act, Fair Labor Standards Act, Fair Credit Reporting Act, Equal Pay Act, and a variety of state laws that are applicable to the hiring process. And this is just a sampler. So it's essential, again, to make sure that whether it is hiring for an adjunct, full-time faculty member, member of the staff, member of the administration, that we take advantage of the support and expertise that legal counsel and HR can provide. And for most of the institutions who are participating today, I would suggest that probably the majority of you, your institutions are institutional members of the National Association of College and University Attorneys, or NACUA. And so your legal counsel are regularly participating with one another on our listserv, where we're discussing these issues, or participating in conferences throughout the year and online programs throughout the year. So there's a wealth of information in terms of just substantive information, as well as templates and other forms and sample policies that we are always discussing and that you also can take advantage of. If we move a couple of slides ahead to job postings and descriptions, again, the job description for a position is the driver of everything. So that if you don't take the time to get this right, the hiring process will have a fundamental flaw that you're always going to have to consider and potentially go back to at a later time. But we want to make sure that we get things right early. So if you anticipate an opening, take the time you need before filling it. Even if you didn't anticipate the opening, someone left suddenly, someone retired, someone passed away, unfortunately, you still need to take the time you need before filling it. And the reason I suggest this is in academe, there's a tendency to stay in positions for a long time. And unfortunately, sometimes there's very little daylight between the position that is being filled and the person who is holding it. And so the position sometimes is the person, and the person is the position. Well, when that person leaves, when the individual who holds the position leaves, this is a huge opportunity to really take a look at what does the institution need here? Have we simply adapted ourselves and the needs of this particular position to the person who held it over time? Or is there something now that's changed in circumstances, institutional need, et cetera? So oftentimes when someone's held a position for 5 years, 10 years, or longer, once that position is empty, it's critical to take the time you need with that job description. On the next page, the next slide, job postings and descriptions, it's essential to really assess and clearly state what the required qualifications are, as well as the essential functions. And we must all agree with regard to what these essential functions are, those who are responsible for drafting that job description. Because those essential functions will also drive interview questions and the ultimate determination of whether a candidate is qualified. We really do not want to rely on the concept of other duties as assigned to pick up the slack and let that concept fill in gaps that we have not articulated appropriately or expressly within the job description. The other thing I'd like to mention is that it's absolutely critical to work with your faculty to create job descriptions. This has been something that many faculty have preferred not to have in place. I think that this is something that has been changing over time. But making sure that we clearly have identified the essential functions, for example, in being a full-time member of the faculty is critical, and let me give you an example of why this is so. Let's say we have a faculty member who is seriously ill and is out for an extended period of time under the Family Medical Leave Act. That faculty member reaches a certain plateau of healing. And as a result of reaching that plateau of healing before returning to work, there is a request for reasonable accommodation. And that request for reasonable accommodation is to be relieved of certain teaching duties. Well, if we never had a job description in place that said that an essential function was teaching, now how do we respond to that request for that accommodation? I've also been in the position of having to, at a certain point, when a faculty member is going to return and there's been no job description in place, actually drafting a letter to the treating physician that articulates a version of a job description that articulates, for example, what the full-time duties and responsibilities are. My preference would be to actually make sure early on that work is done with the faculty in collaboration with HR and where necessary with legal counsel. Moving on to the next page, there are other essential functions that even though certain functions may vary from school to school or department to department, there are other essential functions that are common to all job descriptions. That are listed on that slide, including professionalism, collegiality. Collegiality, we ought to just say it. We ought to just say it's an essential function that individuals are expected to work well with others in support of the institution's mission and vision. If we don't say it up front, don't count on getting it later. If we don't expect that this individual candidate to whom we're making an offer is going to support that concept of collegiality, we aren't going to get it after they're on campus. So we want to make sure that we clearly identify these other essential functions in the job description. Go forward four slides, and we're now in the section on interview essentials. We want to make sure that interview questions are identified by a search committee or those responsible to do the search, and that they are consistently used with each candidate. Again, we're coming back to those three pillars of notice, clarity, and consistency. We also need to understand the types of questions that are legally permissible regarding, and if you go to the next slide, regarding, for example, the candidate's age, education, citizenship, marital status, etc. There are a number of questions that are both appropriate to ask and inappropriate to ask. A couple of examples of inappropriate questions would include the following. How do you feel about being supervised by someone younger than you? Or a second question, that's an unusual first name. Where are you from? As compared to an appropriate interview question with regard to citizenship, are you legally authorized to work in the United States? So this is another point at which collaboration with legal counsel, with HR, can be very helpful in making sure that you have another set of eyes taking a look at the types of interview questions that you are developing for your search committee. I regularly, when searches are getting underway, I regularly will do a little half-hour, 40-minute overview with search committees just so that they have in hand these tools. I'm not getting in the way of the substance of what needs to be addressed, but in terms of providing some support and some tools procedurally, we'll work with search committees on this. On the next slide, again, ensure that the questions relate back to the job description. Do not permit ad hoc or unscripted questions. Now, the response that's come back to me on that is, well, what if somebody says something really fascinating and we want to follow up on it with another question? Now, you know, I don't want to sound like a robot during this interview process and only ask certain questions. I've called the preparation for this type of development anticipated spontaneity. And that really requires search committees to begin to go through some due diligence and begin to anticipate the types of questions that may be asked, the types of questions that may flow from other questions. Again, it's part of the preparation so that the members of the search committee are not surprised, members of the search committee are comfortable with where you need to go. I saw recently, I'm not sure where, I saw this, whether this was on the web within the last week or two, but there was a candidate in a corporate setting that sang all of her responses to interview questions, which clearly had to have had an impact on the interviewers in terms of how do they respond to that. So that's one of the stranger things that I've read over the past week with regard to interviews. But those kinds of things happen. And so if you begin to anticipate where these types of interviews may go in relation to what you are seeking and have articulated in the job description, that will be very helpful. If you go two slides ahead, we're talking now about effective reference and background checks. The key to remember is understanding why they are necessary, who shall conduct them, and how records of these checks will be maintained. Reference checks and background checks are done all over the country, and they must be done because we really do need to understand exactly who we are hiring and why. We also shouldn't count on an ability to fix any concerns we might have once the person has been hired. Anytime there has been a response by someone saying, you know what, they have about 8 out of 10 things that we need. The other 2 things we're going to work on. I try to just as supportively state those other 2 things potentially may be serious enough that within 3 months you may be asking me to draft a severance agreement, or you may be asking me to assist in helping them depart gracefully. So we want to make sure that before the offer is made, that you are satisfied with the information you receive with in response to reference checks and background checks. If you go to the next slide, it would be most helpful to have one person who is designated to conduct the reference checks, someone who has received preparation and training regarding how to make contacts, how to, you know, what kinds of things to listen for in terms of references provided, someone who is comfortable with the development of the documentation and can work with HR or other departments in terms of how that documentation is going to be prepared and retained. We also should be ready to ask a candidate about contacts that can be made that are not currently on the list of references. We want to be careful not to presume to make contacts that without letting the candidate know that we want to possibly talk to others beyond those who are on the list. If you move to the next slide, there are a couple of potential legal issues to be aware of, which is why it's important that in doing reference checks, we're careful. And we need to be aware of the potential for negligent misrepresentation, negligent hiring, and negligent retention. For example, if we find that an employee, a current employee of ours, wants to leave, or we somehow have negotiated a means for that person to leave, and we are happy at some level of happiness that this person actually has decided to leave, and we're so happy that we're going to write that person a reference letter. But the next employer discovers that the very same reasons that we were very concerned about keeping that person on our campus have now begun to show up on their campus. We potentially are walking into a negligent misrepresentation claim. This is a point at which, especially when reference checks are being done, again, feel free to collaborate with legal counsel, with HR, with regard to beginning to decipher some of the information that may be provided to you when you are doing reference checks. A person who may be leaving and applying for a position at your institution may look really great on paper. You may not be at all aware that this individual left their prior campus under a confidential agreement and release, and that there was a very specifically agreed to explanation or reference statement that was going to be made to all future employers. It would be very helpful to you to make sure that you're working with legal counsel and HR, especially legal counsel in this case, who can help you decipher what's being said in that reference and can give you some insight that you might not normally be aware of that might indicate that there were circumstances here that you might not be fully apprised of in terms of that person's departure and application to your institution. Another example, if you receive silence in response to the following question, would you rehire this person? That will speak volumes to you. Going to the next slide, with regard to background checks, we need to make sure that we understand who shall be subject to them, which categories of potential employees will be subject to background check that's compliant with the Fair Credit Reporting Act, for example, adjuncts, You typically are not at an institution going to want to expend money to do a Fair Credit Reporting Act compliant background check on it, on adjuncts or certain other hourly staff. You need to know when and how to utilize the state sexual offender registry. Never did I anticipate in all the years of practice that I would have as many conversations with parole officers as I have had in the practice of education law. Nor did I anticipate that I would be spending as much time as I have in taking a look at who may be listed on the sexual offender registry in particular states, and actually then finding individuals who may be life registrants on that site and may also have expressly stated that they are not to have any contact with minors, which would preclude them immediately from work on your campuses. So again, this is, you know, this is part of the do not do this alone portion of hiring, but it's helpful to make sure that you identify who's going to assist in doing this type of work with you. Going a couple slides ahead, as we're talking about communications during the hiring process, it's critical to identify how you want to use email, which we use all the time and most of the time don't think about it. But search committees should identify what the protocols are going to be with regard to not only the nature and scope of the communication on email, but who is going to speak on behalf of the institution. An NACUA colleague of mine who practiced at the law firm of Holland and Knight provided a definition of email that I give her credit for, but I use in every conceivable moment that I can in terms of presentations, and would offer you this following definition for email. The E in email does not stand for electronic. It stands for evil, eternal, embarrassing evidence. Know why you want to use the email, who needs to be copied on it, what the substance of it needs to be, because you will always, always live with it in some form or another. With regard to social media, Google and Facebook are fair game. There is no expectation of privacy if someone has put photos or statements or other things about themselves out on the web. And so it's fair game for you to take a look at it. It certainly gives you some insight with regard to certain judgment calls by that potential candidate. And again, it's critical to identify who is going to speak on behalf of the institution, because certainly every candidate in that candidate pool is going to presume that whoever is talking to them has the authority to speak on behalf of the of your institution. Going ahead a couple of slides to the...
I'm going to interrupt here briefly.
Sure.
And operator, could you please explain to our listeners how they can pose questions at the end of the presentation?
Yes, sir. If they have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
And if you wish to ask a question but you don't want to be identified or to have your voice heard, you can email it to me at info@insidehighered.com, and I will read the question without reading your without identifying your name or institution. Kathleen, back to you.
Okay, thank you, Scott. We're going ahead a couple of slides to the selection process. The slide begins with a series of kind of due diligence questions here. Are the selection criteria understood by all? That is, it's presumed that in our approach to whatever hiring process we're going to use, that we have determined what the standards will be for the selection of a successful candidate, and that we have agreed to them prior to the search process. So the second question is, has there been any deviation from that established criteria? And then the question for the entire group then to ask is, if so, why? And maybe it was a justifiable deviation. Maybe there was something we actually didn't anticipate that now we want to pay attention to. Well, how do we make sure that we are engaged now in consistent application of that new protocol? And so, again, it takes us back to our concept of notice, concepts of notice, clarity, and consistency. Will a letter of appointment or contract of employment be offered? And who has the authority to make that offer on behalf of the institution? When this kind of prompts a little discussion of offer letters, and sometimes in offer letters we say too much, sometimes we say too little. Certainly an offer letter, a candidate needs to know what the position is they may or may not accept and what the associated duties and responsibilities are. Conversely, an offer letter may contain too much. You know, we want to avoid the everything but the kitchen sink offer letter, especially if that person accepts, there's going to be a number of opportunities to explain other items. So the position offered, the salary associated with that position, associated benefits, and then if there are other things that are going to come later that may, that might be wiser to have that come in subsequent communications. On the next slide, unsuccessful candidates, what do we do? Rejection letters can provide closure, but they can often be very tricky. And there really is a tension that we constantly are engaged in between trying to be humane and saying too much that can be a problem for us. For example, we never want to create a letter that says, although you were well qualified for the position, and then going on and saying you didn't get it. That leaves the unsuccessful candidate with the sense that, well, if I was well qualified, why didn't I get it? And if I didn't get it, it must be due to some other nefarious reason why I didn't get it, or possibly discriminatory reason. Again, with offer letters, we need to think about who authors them, who signs them. I would encourage you to focus on the position, come at those offer letters from an institutional rather than subjectively personal perspective. That is, you know, the position of X is being offered. The salary associated with this position is X, as opposed to saying your salary is. So that from an institutional need perspective, there are things that we are able to adjust in the background, as opposed to saying anything that might otherwise be misinterpreted by a successful candidate to whom an offer is made. What I've attached in the remaining slides is a hypothetical for all of you to use internally to kind of test out many, you know, the information that we've been talking about so far here today. So the next 5 or 6 pages concern a particular hypothetical involving Professor Durable and the actions that were taken and your discussion internally of what actions were appropriate, what other kinds of things should have been done. I also would want to refer you to a couple of recent articles that you may have caught sight of in the Chronicle. On January 22nd and 23rd, there was an article entitled, Are Your References Reliable? That was on January 23rd. And then an article in the Chronicle on the 22nd, The Art of Rejection. And then, Scott, in Inside Higher Ed, there was a follow-up article that pivoted off of the Art of Rejection article in the Chronicle. And with that, I know we sped through quite a bit, but I'm happy to take some questions.
So we have some questions via email in the queue. But, operator, could you please explain one more time how people can ask questions through the queue?
Yes, sir. Again, if you need to ask a question over the phone, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone.
So I'm going to start off. I'm going to combine two questions that I got via email. One question is both about Skype, which is being used by more job interviews. One is just, what do you think of interviews via Skype, and are there issues associated with that? And then the related one is, if you do some interviews for a position on Skype, must you do all your interviews via Skype?
I think, let me take the first part of that question. I mean, this is really the way of the world right now. You know, you may have a candidate in one state, the search firm, if you're involving the search committee, or depending upon the nature of a position that is being that the search is being conducted for, you might have a search firm involved, and they're located in a different city that's completely different from where the institution is. And so Skype becomes a necessity, especially if there are preliminary questions or preliminary interviews that need to be conducted in order to begin to narrow the pool. And so it certainly seems to be a very feasible, reasonable way to go. My only suggestion in response to the second part of that question is I don't think that you need to have everybody on Skype or everybody in person. What you need to have is consistency in terms of what is being asked. What are the protocols you're using during the interview process? So the means are not, I don't think, as critical as the substance of what you're doing during the course of that interview process. So that whether it is by phone, by Skype, and phones are just a dreadful way to go a lot of times, because you just don't have that face-to-face opportunity that you now get increasingly much more in Skype. But whatever you're doing substantively, that is what needs to be consistent.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the first question in the queue, please?
And that question comes from the line of Jean McGill.
Hello. My question is, what's your take on our best practices for creating a selection committee?
That's a great question. You know, I have been working with a number of search committees over the years, and certainly having individuals who are very familiar with the substantive area is helpful. But, you know, it's always interesting to have on that committee as well someone who brings a different perspective or a fresh set of eyes, who can begin to take a look, because if you've got really wonderfully qualified people who are experts in a particular field of scholarship, a particular substantive area of study, whatever it might be, you've got that expertise. But it's also helpful to have on that committee someone who may offer a different perspective in terms of how those candidates are responsible to some of the essential qualities you're looking for in terms of collegiality, professionalism, et cetera, because that person is not kind of enmeshed in the substantive area that you may be focused on. So if I'm in the biology department and I am really focused on the need for creating additional depth in a certain area of scholarship or teaching within biology, that's where I'm really honed in and I'm really prepared. But there may be someone from another area who has been highly regarded in what they do and who is very attuned to what are the personal characteristics that this person may be bringing to this process. What are additional qualities that this person may be bringing that would add to the wealth of information that the search committee has. So that having that type of diversity, I think, is going to be helpful to you.
Thank you. I want to read another question from by email. Can you explain what you mean by, quote, statement regarding the institution's right to modify the job posting or description, end
yes.
quote, specifically modify the job posting or description?
Yes, and that comes back to an area that I wanted to touch on, and we were just kind of moving things along. Let's say we have a pretty good pool. We think we have a pretty good pool. We keep moving forward. We're investing a lot of time and resources in getting the committee together. We're getting it down to a manageable size. But let's say let's say that the final pool of candidates just doesn't match up ultimately. We had every hope but the final pool doesn't really match up to what we're looking for. We've interviewed them, and it's just not going the way we want it to go. Now what? Sometimes we feel compelled to simply keep going and pick one of them. Well, the question that I have posed is why? Is there not an opportunity to take a pause and say, you know, maybe we need to reconsider something. Maybe we need to take a look at that posting again. Maybe we need to look at that job description again. Is there something that we have stated within that job description or posting that we haven't articulated well, but the manner in which we've articulated it is now reflected in the pool that we have? And so the ability to have discretion to modify that is maybe we need to just put the search in abeyance. Maybe we need to stop the search. Maybe we need to reconsider what we need and to afford ourselves as a search committee in consultation with a dean or a chair or the provost. We need to kind of reconnoiter and find out what's going on here. It's that ability to state that we reserve the right to do this, to actually make modifications, that would permit us to have the opportunity to say, you know, we've suspended the search at this particular point. Now, you may down the road, or, you know, in a timely way, indicate that either we've suspended the search, we've ended the search for institutional reasons, we've suspended it, but, you know, if we've gotten down to the final pool, indicate to those individuals that at a later time they would be free to reapply. I mean, there are a number of things that can be done, but you want to be able to afford yourselves institutionally the opportunity to say, okay, if there's something substantial that develops and we need to take the time to review it, to carefully assess what's going on, that's what that was for.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Yes, sir. And next in the line, we have Virginia Galderi.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have a question regarding background checks. Mm-hmm. And are there any practices that you know of where an institution has gone back in time and instituted background checks on their faculty and staff? For instance, we instituted background checks starting in 2005. Has there been an occasion, or are you aware of going back, and what would be best practice in terms of
typically when you're adopting policies and procedures, and, you know, many institutions will have a policy on policies that kind of sets up the whole manner in which you get started, but then when policies are adopted, unless it's expressly stated within the policy, the expectation is that it will be from the effective date forward.
Right.
Absent some real clarity in that policy, and identifying any exceptions to that, you know, then the concern becomes, well, why weren't we concerned about this before? And sometimes the effort to try and really now make good use of that policy, we engage in certain decision-making that might somehow become a distraction to the underlying concern we have of making sure that everybody is appropriately credentialed, that there's no criminal conviction that substantially interferes with their work, et cetera.
Right.
One of the things that if there is something that comes to light, there is an opportunity. I mean, we're going to have to do an assessment and make an assessment as to whether, let's say that something comes to light that this person was engaged in 5 years ago. Well, I would suggest that we would have to do some due diligence to assess, okay, here's what has come to light. Does this fact, let's say it's a conviction of something, mm-hmm. does the fact of this conviction substantially interfere with this individual's performance of their duties and responsibilities? Now, if it comes to light after 5 years that this, because we never checked the sexual predator registry for the state, and
right.
this person is a permanent registrant, then my suggestion would be HR and legal counsel are in that meeting with you right away in order to, especially if there is expressly stated on there that this person shall not have any involvement with any minor. Now we've got some work to do right away. But if it is, was convicted of assault, and this was 5 years ago, then the question becomes, okay, what do we need to know about this? What due diligence do we need to do? Was this someone who was involved in a scuffle on a Friday night near a bar that related to work as a grad student that has had no impact on their life since?
Right.
Those are the so there's some due diligence involved in what you want to do there. And I hate to pull a typical lawyer on you, but it really kind of depends on what the nature of the circumstances are, and is there something that the disclosure of which potentially creates legal exposure or some type of health or safety issue, and if not, then what is the due diligence that we want to apply? But fundamentally, I would say that the policy should be it's from this date forward so that everybody, again, has sufficient notice. But that being said, there's also an opportunity to say to individuals that there's an ongoing duty to report, that if someone is involved in a situation that could potentially substantially interfere with their ability to perform their duties and responsibilities, it at least gives you, in a supervisory sense, the opportunity while there's an investigation or whatever legal process might be involved to place that person on some type of administrative leave and do an investigation.
Right. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. Another question via email. Many faculty search committees take job candidates out for dinner and drinks to interact in an informal way. Do you have any thoughts about these events, whether they're wise, and if faculty committees do them, how they should do them?
Sadly, we only have 5 minutes left in the program because this is something where and this is one of the reasons why I have focused on this in presentations and in-services and working with faculty. There is informality, but there should never be lost in that informality the fact that the candidate is always, always, always presuming that what you are saying or doing is on behalf of that institution. And so if you're out for dinner and drinks and you've just enjoyed a nice couple glasses of wine and the candidate leans in and says, all right, now give me the real skinny on what's happening here, and all of you are forthcoming, now what? You're never going to retract that. And so what I like to work on is just have a conversation with the search committee and say, tell me what processes you like to use. You want people to, if they're going to spend so many hours in this community, this particular university community, you want them to be comfortable. They're living there. You want them to be an integral part of the community. But you are still in the interview process. And though we don't want to, though we don't want people to act unnaturally or robot-like again, we do need to make sure that we all understand that what is said, what's inferred, could be taken and used in a wide variety of ways by a candidate. Now, I'm always starting from the premise and will always say that lawyers are trained to start from the worst case scenario and work backward, so I can't help myself on that. But it's easier in my work with faculty search committees to start from that point and then to just converse together and make suggestions on how to still make that an easy and comfortable meeting, but also to be cognizant of what we say and what we do.
This is my follow-up question to that question. What's your advice on booze at such events?
Well, if you know that you are someone who becomes a major talker with one glass of wine, then I would have a Diet Coke. If you think that it's something that I mean, I think you just kind of, as a search committee, I think that you just have to have a close eyeball-to-eyeball chat with one another to say, how are we going to conduct this dinner in a way that not only creates the best light of our institution for these candidates, but the best light with regard to us. And that would be, I mean, that's something that we have to be ready to be candid with one another.
Well, I have to say, we run a lot of advice Q&As from job seekers, and issues related to those dinners are a frequent topic of fear by candidates and search committees. I'm afraid that's all the time we have today for this discussion. I want to thank our listeners. We're going to be sending you an evaluation form so you can offer suggestions for future audio conferences. And I want to thank our listeners for excellent questions. And Kathleen, thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
Thank you, everybody.
Have a good day.